you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children. That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust? Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
So welcome, everyone. I'm Hillary Kane from the great state of Pennsylvania, and I'm one of your honorary co-chairs today. I'm joined with me by Kenneth Mejia from California. Kenneth, are you there?
Hey, Hillary. Yep, Kenneth Mejia here from sunny California. Great to be here, Hillary.
Great, good to see you. So welcome, everyone. We are here to host the 2020 nominating convention. I'm going to start off by giving us a brief overview of the day. So for many of you, this is your very first presidential nominating convention. And let me give a special welcome to those first timers. In the Green Party, we do things a little bit differently. Today will not be the highly scripted media spectacle that we've come to expect from the two major parties. Today is a working meeting where real grassroots democracy takes place. We will have votes on various items from our platform to our presidential candidate. The first item of business is the approval of our credentialing co-chairs report. That will be followed by the approval of our 2020 platform.
Awesome. And just a quick introduction about me, everyone. I'm from California. I ran for Congress here as a Green Party member in 2017 and 2018, and I'm happy to be co-hosting here with Hillary and serving all of you. So like Hillary said, I'm here to tell you all, if you're watching, and how to participate. So for delegates, alternates, and registered observers, you all are using Zoom, the Zoom webinar. And when delegates or alternates have to vote, you will be using Lumio. And of course, it's lumio.org if you haven't checked in yet. And everyone else who's watching from home, from the audience, you all can watch from our Facebook live stream on YouTube and Twitter. And if you're not sure, you could also go to gp.org/live, where we'll have all the links to all our live streams. And we'll also have live captioning embedded.
Okay, so I guess we just want to talk a little bit about how we got chosen to be the honorary co-chairs for the day. So that was a vote that was decided by our national committee. So each Green Party across the country, there's state level chapters. Those chapters and state parties send delegates to our national party, and that's the official decision-making body of the Green Party. And so the decision of who gets to host the convention today, among other roles that are selected, was taken place over vote a couple of weeks ago by our national committee. And it is certainly a great honor and privilege for both myself and for Kenneth in order to be chosen for this role. So Kenneth, I know you got to say a little bit about yourself, and that's great. I myself am from Pennsylvania. I am the treasurer of the Green Party nationally. So I'm the one who keeps the books and handles all the money. But my story, I know, is a lot less exciting than yours, Kenneth. So I know you came to be a Green around 2016. You ran for office. You have a really great story. So why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are and how you became a member of the Green Party?
Yeah, so, you know, just my journey on how I became a Green Party member was, like many people watching here today probably, they came from the Bernie Sanders camp. They were burners, and they were really fighting against wealth and income inequality, you know, things that made sense, but we didn't know why it existed in the first place. And so when I saw someone like Bernie, I was like, all right, I'm gonna get involved. I was a Democrat before I was a Green my entire life. And then sort of once I saw the machine, the DNC, the Democratic Party sort of screw over Bernie, I was like, I'm sick of it. I don't want to have anything with the Democratic Party at all. And luckily, there was an amazing candidate running at the time, because once Bernie was there, I didn't know what to do. You know, I was either going to stay Democrat. But then luckily, I found out about the one and only Dr. Jill Stein. And so I ended up joining the Green Party because she was fighting for, I mean, her slogan was people, planet, and peace over profit. And that was, and everything she was fighting for was like Bernie on steroids. That's what Jill said. And that's sort of how I got involved with the Green Party. And ever since then, I haven't looked back. I'm proud to be a Green. You know, I try to stay involved. We're building here locally in Los Angeles, the LA Greens. So if any of you live in LA, reach out to me. And, you know, it's just been a pleasure. And, you know, what keeps me staying and keeps me strong as a Green is our platform, no matter what. I could always rely back on our platform and look at the things we value, like single-payer healthcare, healthcare for all, canceling student debt, you know, immigration for all, things that the Democratic Party is now stealing from us, like the Green New Deal. And I could always fall back on that and be like, you know, the Greens started that trend. So that's sort of how I became a Green. And then I ran for office in 2016 and 2017 and 2018. And luckily, and you know, proudly, we got the highest percentage of the vote as a Green against a Democrat in Green Party history, getting close to 30% of the vote against an incumbent Dem. So I'm proud to be a Green. I'll be Green my whole life, no matter what happens. So that's a little bit about me. Hillary, what about yourself?
Sure. So, I mean, that's a fabulous story. So I've actually been a Green for about 20 years, which is hard to believe. And, you know, in some ways, my story is, you know, it's similar but different. So in the year 2000, I was also in my 20s. So that dates me a bit. And, you know, I was a Democrat, and the primary then, you know, was Al Gore and Bill Bradley from New Jersey. And, you know, I had just graduated college, and Bill Bradley seemed exciting to me. He was talking about race, which to me was a really important issue, and nobody else was talking about it. And so I got involved. I, you know, went up to New Hampshire with a busload of other young people, and I knocked on doors and really got my first taste of politics. And, you know, I came back to Philadelphia, and I think our Pennsylvania has a sort of late-ish primary, maybe April, May. And by that point, Bradley was done, right? The decision was made. It was going to be Al Gore. And I had just, you know, I never got into Al Gore. You know, he was part of that whole Clinton team, you know, the team that ended welfare as we know it and pushed through the crime bill authored by Joe Biden. Various other things that really just didn't sit well with me. And so I was looking for alternatives. And around the same time, I also was educating myself and learning more about the issues. I started learning more about, you know, free trade versus fair trade. For those of you who might have been around in 2000, a lot of the politics was on global trade agreements, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund. And so I went down to DC for a protest with some friends, a protest against the WTO. And I'm, you know, looking at the speakers, and this guy gets up on stage and starts talking, and it's Ralph Nader. And I was like, hey, I've heard of that guy. He's a big deal. He's done some good things. And, you know, he says he's running for president as a Green. And so I, you know, was really intrigued. And I remember I came back to Philadelphia, and I joked that I had to search in Yahoo because Google didn't exist yet. And I had to look up what the Green Party was. And the first thing I read was the 10 key values. And that was it. You know, just like you said about the platform, you know, I read through those 10 key values and I was like, these are my values. This is the group that I have been waiting for. And I went to my first local meeting, and as they say, the rest is history. And so I have been, you know, I guess I'm a Green for life too, 20 years and counting. And, you know, having served at all levels of the party, starting at my local, working my way up to my state party, supporting candidates along the way, and now the pleasure is mine to serve the party at the national level. So, you know, in some ways it's funny that we kind of have in some ways similar paths, but it's also, you know, it's another, it underscores for me how the Democratic Party, you know, in some ways never changes, and it's the same old story year after year. So, all right. So I think we're going to turn it over to some other folks, Kenneth, and get the next item of business going. Is that right?
Yes, we are. We are going to turn it over. And like Hillary said before she made that point, is, you know, the Democratic Party is a dead end. And it's literally going to take pulling and and pulling strings, and it's like joining the mafia to change from the inside. And you know, what have we seen? It never works. And you know, we've seen the task force that Bernie and Biden are on right now. They're not even passing things like Medicare for all or legalizing marijuana, things that we've been seeing that we've been pushing for. And so, you know, it's just a show. And, you know, it's time, if you're figuring out whether you need to leave the party, the Democratic Party, join the Green Party.
You'll have 20 minutes to vote. I know the majority of you have used Lumio to vote in our mock elections, but we know some of you might need a little more time. While our delegates vote, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Reverend Seth Capperdale. Reverend Seth Capperdale and his co-pastor wife, Stephanie, have served the Reformed Church of Highland Park in New Jersey since 2001. In addition to traditional church ministry, Seth has created a robust network of church-based nonprofits that exist to provide affordable housing, disaster relief, and reentry support after prison, mental health services, immigrant advocacy, and support for veterans, unaccompanied minors, victims of trafficking, asylees, and refugees. Seth has also created a refugee-run cafe and a fair trade marketplace and an organization to support those with cancer. Seth serves as president of the board of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. In 2013, Seth published his first book, A Voice for Justice, Sermons That Prepared a Congregation to Respond to God in the Decade After 9/11. In 2017, Seth was the Green Party of New Jersey's candidate for governor. Seth and his wife have three daughters, Sina, Leah, and Cora.
Change anything if he becomes president, that he'll keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, that he will keep the deadly sanctions that kill people in Iran and Venezuela and Zimbabwe and Cuba and so many other countries. But we know we can't have justice here and have injustice abroad. Greens do not see foreign policy as a frill. And so we demand that the defense budget be cut. A defense budget that takes up 60% of the federal budget ensures that the people's needs cannot be met. We want to get rid of the 1033 Defense Department program, which gives surplus equipment, military equipment, to local police departments. And we know that the Democrats, despite any complaints about us, raised $1 billion and then couldn't get more than an additional 10,000 votes in the state of Michigan. So we have to commit ourselves to step forward this year, to organize ourselves and to organize people who have no experience with the Green Party. And I challenge all of us, myself included, to make certain that we have an impact in our communities and that we introduce people to the Green Party platform. They already know about it. They know the Green New Deal, which Democrats claim to want, started with us. So here we are, and we have to be honest about what we want. Are we a real political party? We're not an affinity group. We're not a club. And we should not call ourselves a party if we're not working to elect more Greens to office and to grow our numbers. Where is this movement headed? It's an important time, but it's also dangerous. People must act with knowledge. It's easy to grasp on to the hot slogan of the moment, but people are inadvertently agitating for things which may not be as they seem. Defunding police can lead to budgetary sleight of hand, which also does nothing to change the nature of policing. We must demand community control of the police, community control of every aspect of our lives. And then we will have a real democracy in this country, but the Green Party must lead this effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Margaret. That was great. And like, I am personally over the two-party cartel. I'm done with it. And the Greens are the way to go. Margaret mentioned getting rid of one of them. Let's get rid of both. Let's bring in something new. It is time for something new.
I really liked her call to action to Greens to kind of challenge us, push us to kind of step up a little bit. You know, we've always known that the values we've been fighting for are the right values that people's support. We just need to get more organized. We need to speak to people that are not already part of our party. It was just a strong challenge for people inside and outside of the Green Party to move in a better direction. So, Kristen, how long have you been in the Green Party?
I joined in 2013. It was right after the Obama got elected that second time. I walked out of the voting booth in 2012 and was just not happy about voting for him. I was jazzed in 2008. I bought into that hope and change and then was grossly disappointed. That's not what happened. We got more of the same. So I voted again for him in 2012 and saw Jill's name on the ballot. I didn't know about her, but I saw her name. And so when I walked out, I researched her and found out about the Green Party and took that little I side with quiz, you know, said I'm like 99% green. And ended up going to a Green Party meeting really like the next week and was sitting next to Sherry Hankala, which she had just been the vice presidential candidate, and thought that was so cool. It took me a couple more months to register, but I really just have never looked back.
While our delegates are busy casting their votes, we are going to hear from some amazing speakers right now. And we're going to start off with the four-term Minneapolis City Council member, Cam Gordon. And a little bit about Cam Gordon is, since first being elected in 2005, Cam has used the green values of social justice, ecological wisdom, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence to guide and work in city government. Among the large body of work he has done as city council member, Cam is most often recognized for the leadership and energy he has provided to issues of racial equity, civic participation, public health, environmental justice, clean energy, violence prevention, and local foods. He's a founding member and former party chair of the Green Party of Minnesota. And as the Minneapolis City Council member for Ward 2, Cam Gordon chairs the council's Housing Policy and Development Committee, vice chairs the Public Health, Environment, Civil Rights, and Engagement Committee, and serves on the Budget Committee of the Whole Economic Development and Regulatory Services, Elections and Rules, Transportation and Public Works, and Zoning and Planning. You could also find out more about this greencamgordon.org. And if you didn't know, Cam Gordon was also one of the nine who voted to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department. So Cam Gordon, everyone.
Hello, I'm Cam Gordon. I'm sorry I can't be with you today, but I just wanted to send you a message of support and goodwill from Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I've been serving on the Minneapolis City Council now for the past 14 years, representing the Green Party in our city government. And I just want you to know that getting organized at the local level, running for office, then other elected officials latch onto those. Using the value of grassroots democracy, we've been able to make ranked choice voting the way we elect our city government here in the city of Minneapolis, and that includes at-large seats for the park board that are elected proportionally. And we've done that successfully year after year and opened up our system here. Using social and economic justice to guide us, we've been able to raise the minimum wage here in the city of Minneapolis, and we've also established a racial equity action plan trying to address what are some of the worst disparities in any city in the country, in racial disparities that we have in the city of Minneapolis. It wasn't easy, but we did that work. Using nonviolence, we were able to create a division of violence prevention. We've been able to move programs forward, working through hospitals, co-responders in our police department, so that we can address the issue of violence from a public health perspective, which has been key and which has been very, very, very important. And using the value of ecological wisdom, we created a very strong climate action plan in our city. We now have a clean energy partnership with our utility companies, after a failed effort to take over them, but that's still something that could be done in the future. But we also were able to develop a green zones program so that we can bring resources to the communities that need them most, who've been subjected to environmental injustice for decades in the city of Minneapolis. And we have now have clean energy goals to phase out of the use of fossil fuels in our city. And people are latching on to those ideas, and they're becoming more and more popular. I also wanted to talk about one of the biggest struggles that we're in right now in Minneapolis, and I'm sure people have heard about the focal point with the police murder of George Floyd, that tragic death, and then everything that has resulted. We have a new opportunity in our city, and we're looking at what we can do to change significantly from top to bottom and transform our, even the way we approach community safety, public safety, and policing in the city of Minneapolis. We're moving forward now with a charter amendment. That we've tried charter amendments in the past, but to deal with this problem, but now I think we have the best hope where we will actually remove the police department from our charter and replace it with a Department of Community Safety and Violence Prevention. We're gonna work hard at developing police oversight mechanisms in the meantime while we push that charter amendment forward onto the ballot. We passed a historic resolution, I think unanimously by the city council, saying we're going to engage in a year-long community process where we're going to help everybody reimagine what public safety could be like, and we're going to listen to one another so we can understand. Well, some people might think the system of paramilitary policing that we've had so far works for them. It doesn't work for everybody in our city, and it has resulted in tragedy time and time again in the city of Minneapolis. In order for us to do that, though, we're really going to need the help of everybody, everybody in the city, and also voices from outside the city to help guide us in this new direction. I believe that Minneapolis has an opportunity to be a model for other cities and into the future about how we can rethink, redo, recreate, and rebuild public safety, destroy the institutionalized racism that is in our criminal justice system, certainly at the city level, and we can offer a new pathway forward. But we need your ideas, everybody's ideas, and the expertise out there too. And we also need people at every city, in every state, every county, every school board, park board, organizing and building and talking about it and having this discussion and carrying our Green Party values forward into the future. We can build at the local level, and it's also important that we're building at the national level. So I really appreciate that people are able to engage at that level and work on these national campaigns. And I encourage everybody, remember, there's also elected offices locally. Get involved. You can really make a difference. And the Green Party values and our platform can be a guide to help you get there. Thank you very much, and good luck with the rest of your conference.
So our next speech while we cast our votes is from our 2016 vice presidential candidate, Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu Baraka is the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace and was the 2016 candidate for vice president on the Green Party ticket. Baraka serves on the executive committee of the U.S. Peace Council and leadership body of the United National Anti-War Coalition. He is an editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report and contributing columnist for Counterpunch. He was recently awarded the U.S. Peace Memorial 2019 Peace Prize and the Serena Sherm Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism.
Oh, here we go. My name is Ajamu Baraka. I am a committed member of the Green Party and was on the ballot in 2016. This is a very, very important historical moment. And I'm honored to have an opportunity to share a few comments. Objectively, we have to understand the context in which the Green Party is operating, both international and domestic. We have a grinding economic crisis in which there are irreconcilable contradictions that we have to come to terms with. Both in the international economy and domestically. Domestically, we have a situation where people never really recovered from the downturn of the economy in 2007 and 2008. But now as a consequence of the veritable collapse of the economy, as a consequence of COVID-19, And we have a situation that for many people in the U.S. and really around the world is dire. It's quite clear that the ruling class is more concerned with saving the economy than the lives of the people. And that's why we've seen the kinds of moves that were made by the Trump administration with the full support of the corporate class to drive people back into the economy, even when it was quite clear that the number of COVID-19 cases was on the rise. This is understandable, but it is the context now that we are dealing with, that basically people have been radicalized. They understand that they are just mere cogs in a capitalist machine, and they are looking for alternatives. There is no economic recovery. The contradictions of the current system suggest that there will be no return to normal. In fact, for many of us, normal was in fact catching hell. The objective logic of the rulers today is a increasing dependence on force and violence. That's why we see the expansion of the military budget. That's why we're experiencing intensified domestic repression, nuclear upgrading and redeployments. All of these reflect a desperate attempt on the part of the rulers to use force and violence in order to maintain their hegemony. But we're not going to be deterred. We understand and we accept these conditions as the context that the party has to be prepared to operate in. And we're going to do that and resist the opportunism that other parties engage in. We're going to adhere to our principles and boldly state the Green Party program. This provides tremendous opportunities for the Green Party. It's quite clear that the Green Party has been driving progressive discourse in this country for a number of years. Now we have an opportunity to provide the kinds of answers that people are looking for. The people recognize that there's no democracy in this country. They recognize that basically they have no real objective human rights that are being respected and promoted by the state. Therefore, they are looking for real alternatives that are grounded in a new kind of ethical framework. And that ethical framework, that political program, the Green Party really represents. But the party has to be ready. It has to be ready for the moment. It has to be prepared to look at itself critically, to make sure that it is getting itself in position to absorb the influx that the party is experiencing. It means that the party has to be, and the party activists have to be more visible on a local level. The party, the state party structures have to open up themselves for more participation, committed to expanding the party base across the country. It means that we have to pull behind the party nominee and go out into the public and push the party's program with boldness and confidence, understanding that we're going to be the object of criticism, but that we are in fact on the right side of history. So this is the moment for the Green Party. It means that we have to prepare ourselves. We have to engage in conversations, sometimes painful struggle, to make sure that we are really positioned to take advantage of this moment and to go forward. So I salute everyone who's participating in this fantastic gathering. Let us go forward and build the kind of instrument that the historical moment demands. Let us be reminded that we are, in fact, the party that puts the people, planet, and peace over profit. And therefore, our growth opportunity is enormous. So let's build the party. Let's create a new U.S. and, indeed, a new world. Thank you so much.
All right. So I think at this point, we are going to do one more speaker before our next, the next section of our agenda. So before the next break, I'm going to introduce our next and final speaker for this section, Jenny Leong. Jenny Leong is a state member for the electorate of Newtown in the New South Wales Legislative Assembly. Jenny has been an active member of the Greens for over a decade. In 2013, she worked as the federal election campaign coordinator for the New South Wales Greens. And of course, this is in Australia. Jenny was elected to parliament at the New South Wales state election on the 28th of March in 2015. Her statewide portfolio includes responsibilities for the New South Wales Greens, including human rights, sex, sexuality, and gender identity, housing and homelessness, women's rights, multiculturalism, Western Sydney, and climate change. So just a few things. Jenny is a passionate advocate for equality, justice, and human rights, and has a long track record of standing up and speaking out against racism, sexism, discrimination, and the politics of fear. She is strongly committed to ensuring we maintain the diversity and creativity of our city, or their city, by removing the privatization agenda that prevents housing, transportation, and public services from serving people and communities. Let's hear from Jenny Leong.
Hi, Jenny. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
Hi, Jane.
It.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been so excited by the idea that I get to see you again, because of course it's been a while since being there at your second election night victory party. Definitely one of my favorites. So I just want to jump right in today, if that's all right.
Thanks.
The first question is just, what is your proudest accomplishment as a two-term Green MLA in Sydney, Australia, in Newtown specifically?
Yeah, look, it's really hard, I think, for us as Greens. We come to the concept of how we want to achieve change in the world through a sense of collective action, you know? So it always feels weird when people ask me about like my achievements, or we talk about like my election victory. Because to me, it's like, I know, like you were one of the people on the campaign, like, you know, I know that without hundreds of volunteers and people doing all of that effort, then I would not have been elected. And then all of the things that we achieve in terms of wins wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for massive amounts of community movements and campaigns before I even, you know, was around in politics. So it feels really hard to identify a moment. But I would say that I feel like the one that is in the most sort of forefront of my mind is that last year in New South Wales, we finally managed to decriminalize abortion. And a few years before that, we managed to give an apology to the 78ers, who were the first people that marched in the Mardi Gras parade that suffered massive police brutality and violence and homophobia as a result of them trying to engage in a peaceful rally and protest down Oxford Street in Sydney at our first ever Mardi Gras back in 78. And so to me, I see those as incredible moments in our collective history around the push for equality, around LGBTIQ rights, and also around the idea of women's rights and reproductive rights. And the fact that I got to be in Parliament to be part of the apology given to those 78ers at that first Mardi Gras, and that I was in Parliament and had my name as one of the Greens members on the bill that worked to decriminalise abortion in New South Wales, feel like definitely, you know, moments in time that I got to be a part of because of incredible Greens members being able to elect representatives to the parliament, that then meant that we were part of not just the history at the time and those movements at the time that had been pushing for it, but also being able to achieve what was really significant change to communities, LGBTIQ communities and feminist communities here in Sydney and across, you know, the country, because those things are significant.
Great. I mean, thank you. And it actually leads almost perfectly into my next question, which is, if I remember correctly, you ended up having a child during your first term in Parliament. And I can only imagine that as a first termer and as one of the relatively few women in Parliament, that meant a lot of changes. And I just wondered, I thought sometimes people are really curious, how does someone handle juggling being a mother, being a new mother, and actually being a member of Parliament?
Yeah, look, I think there are, it's true. I laughed and said, you know, within 2 years, I got two new titles. I got MP and Mum. And they were both titles that I never would have expected I would have either of them or really planned to have either of them. So it was a big shock. In one hand, the flexibility that I have around some parts of my work make it a lot easier for me than other women. I am in a really privileged position with my role that if I need to cancel meetings on a day, then I can cancel them and I can't get the sack. Whereas if someone's doing shift work, the risk is if you're in insecure employment and your child is sick, then you risk losing your job if you have to take the day off. So on one hand, there's a huge privilege that goes with the kind of role that I have because I have that flexibility. On the other hand, the expectations to be out and about all the time, when Parliament's sitting, you don't have that flexibility. At events and activities, that's really tough. But it's also very tough to sort of negotiate what is your very public facing life and the realities of having sort of, you know, crusty food on your clothes while you're trying to do a news interview or during ISO lockdown. I at one point was doing a radio interview while dancing with my daughter while she was listening to Frozen soundtrack to try and keep her distracted while I was giving my grabs. So there are definite negotiations and challenges, but I think they are challenges that all working people with young children face, particularly the pressures on women with the various, you know, challenges around the disproportionate level of care and responsibility that women lift and the mental load that women carry. And it's one of the reasons why I'm such a strong advocate for free childcare, for free early childhood education, and for making sure that, you know, you should be able to access these high quality services to make sure the younger generation doesn't suffer because their parents choose to want to engage in meaningful and productive work.
Against the mold, without a doubt, singled out the only way I know. Cause I wanna be the minority. I don't need your authority. Down with the moral majority. Cause I wanna be the minority. Stepped out of the line, like a sheep runs from the herd, marching out of time. Dark, blinded by the silence of a thousand broken hearts, who cried out loud. She screamed under me, a threat for all. Oh, you are your side, cause I wanna be the majority. I don't need your authority. Down with the moral majority, cause I wanna be the majority.
So greetings to the press, good morning, and thank you all for joining us. This is our premier inaugural series, Virtual Press Conferences for the Green Party of the United States 2020 Presidential Nominating Convention. This is an experiment for us, probably for most of you. So before this gets started, I want to go over a few points.
Sorry, thanks, Holly. It was a little noisy in the background here while you were speaking. So good morning, everyone, and welcome to the 2020 Green Party of the United States annual meeting and presidential nominating convention. You know, obviously the main event is for the delegates to vote for our presidential and vice presidential nominee, but it's also important to bring the Green Party message of sustainability, peace, and social and economic justice to as many voters as possible. And that's why I'm really pleased to be able to bring you some of our other candidates running for federal office. So our first candidate, Joseph Nahum. He's a congressional candidate for the 4th District in Nassau, Long Island, New York. Joseph is a sanitation boat captain for the town of Hempstead, a husband, a stay-at-home, dad who managed to give his son loving attention while organizing for the Green Party. And since we work in New York together, I can attest to that directly. Joey's Green Party positions include Green Party of Nassau County chairperson, a delegate to the Green Party of New York, and a National Committee alternate delegate for New York. He's also a board member of Long Island's not-for-profit Farmers Market, Beach to Bay Civic Environmental Committee co-chair, an avid gardener, and endorsed by the Long Island activists. Joey.
Good morning. Thank you to the organizers of the Green Party Presidential Nominating Convention for inviting me to speak here with you. It has been a long-standing Sephardic tradition of my family to service others. I fought to improve our community's groundwater systems away from toxic plumes, saltwater intrusion, and E. coli. I fought to help save our surface water ecosystems from plastic, raw sewage, dioxins, and other calamitous pollutants. But while I've done everything I can at home, the status quo in Washington has been just that, a status quo. I am running for Congress because I am renting the earth from my children. I, as a father in our community, know how challenging it is to provide safe, constructive experiences for children during a pandemic. Parents cannot compromise on healthy and peacefully stimulating environments to transition our families to. Most of our government officials have been assuming the status quo is the answer you need. Governor Cuomo won't enact the stock transfer tax, which would provide $8 billion to needed local school districts following the revenue loss caused by the pandemic. Cuomo doesn't want to raise taxes on his billionaire contributors and has avoided any discussion about the stock transfer tax solution. Instead, he is cold-heartedly betting on low and middle-income people living in frontline communities, picking up the tab instead of the profiteering billionaires. Congresswoman Kathleen Rice has voted in support of every military budget increase, voted unfavorably in response to Trump's increasing authority over the military, and has never signed on to the Green New Deal. If elected, I will serve our people in ways that most people never have the courage to. If elected, I will prescribe a COVID-19 economic stimulus package that embraces the Green New Deal, a commitment to transition to zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, combined with an economic bill of rights that raises the living standards for all Americans. This would include a guaranteed living wage job and income, single-payer health care, and the right to quality housing and free education, including college. A recent study by Oxford University shows that a green economic stimulus is far more cost-effective in creating jobs than traditional infrastructure projects. Climate change poses an existential threat to the future of life on the planet. The two corporate parties have wasted the last three decades. We need to radically transform our country's energy and political system in the next decade. The House Democratic leadership this week proposed another three decades for a partial reduction in emissions, while the GOP focuses on protecting the profits and wealth of the fossil fuel industry and the financial backers. Even more progressive Democrats like AOC have failed to call for a halt, a new fossil fuel infrastructure, or a ban on fracking. The Democrats still focus on increasing profits for private investors with schemes like carbon capture and sequestration and promotion of biomass, helping factory farming. In 2012, our city of Long Beach, New York was inundated with raw sewage and tens of thousands of us were displaced as a result of Superstorm Sandy. Democrats just give this issue lip service, including the need to help third world countries survive the crisis industrial polluting nations have caused. Mind you that low-income and frontline communities have always been disproportionately and negatively impacted by this perpetuating climate crisis, COVID-19, and police brutality. If elected, I will fund our Green New Deal proposals with a 75% cut in the military budget, higher taxes on the wealthy, and a robust carbon tax starting at least $40 a ton. And I hope that you share this campaign and join us as we raise high the banner of social justice principles, protecting the quality of our environment and human rights to change the world now. Please join our cause at josephnaham.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Our next candidate, Justin Apanglino, is the Green Party candidate for United States Congress, Connecticut's 3rd District. Justin is an MD and a PhD who recently transitioned from work in science and virology to dedicate more time to political activism. He lives with his wife and two children, teaches piano, and plays piano and keyboards in a few local bands. As a physician and an organizer, Justin believes that we all deserve health care, regardless of how much we can afford to pay, and that Medicare for all is the right of all Americans. Justin.
Oh, thank you very much, Gloria. Good morning to everyone. Thanks for coming. Hope you're all are well. I am Dr. Justin Apanglino. I've never run for office before. As Gloria said, I come from a medical and a science background. I have an MD and I have a PhD in virology. I'm here because I believe we all deserve healthcare, and I want to work to see that we get Medicare for all. Today in America, many go without needed drugs, doctor's visits, or surgeries simply because they can't afford them. Many go bankrupt just trying to pay their medical bills, many of these people with health insurance. Under Medicare for All legislation, everyone would get healthcare. Any person would be able to go to any doctor or hospital and get care, but all the charges would be paid by a single payer, Uncle Sam. How much would this cost? Less. A recent scientific review of the studies on this question showed that Medicare for All would be less expensive than our current system, up to 15% cheaper, saving us up to $500 billion a year. So we really need to do this, and we really have no excuse not to extend healthcare to all Americans. The cost, again, which would be less, could be covered using our progressive income tax system. That's how I prefer to have it funded. The Medicare for All Act of 2019 has not been brought up for a debate by the House leadership, despite having support from 2 out of 3 Americans, 85% of Democrats, and having 118 co-sponsors in the House. My representative is not one of those 118 co-sponsors, but I would be. When I'm on the ballot, Medicare for All will be on the ballot. There are many other issues I am passionate about, but I know that the skills I've developed from my science career could be applied to addressing all these issues, any issue that a congressperson has to face. Medicare for All, ranked choice voting, which is a simple electoral reform that would open up democracy to more than just two parties, that I'd like to talk about more if there's time. Clean energy, a fair economy, spending our tax dollars on our welfare, not on unnecessary warfare, diligent science-based public health. These are all things I stand for, believe in, and have passion to fight for. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin. Our next candidate, Lisa Savage, candidate for United States Senate in Maine. Lisa Savage is a public school teacher and organizer, a mother of 5, and a grandmother of 4. And to me, that is a formidable force to bring into office. She's a former vice president and chief negotiator for the local bargaining unit of the Maine Education Association. And as a committed environmental advocate, Lisa founded the Maine Natural Guard, a group working to protect Maine's environment by connecting the dots between the climate emergency and the Pentagon's massive greenhouse gas emissions. Lisa.
Thank you, Gloria, and thank you, Holly. Thank you, candidates, and thank you, press, for being here. I appreciate the Green Party giving me this opportunity to address you this morning. So I am Lisa Savage. I'm a candidate for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Susan Collins. It's a ranked choice voting election, and the primary is Tuesday, so we don't know who our Democratic opponent will be yet, but we're pretty sure it's going to be a very corporate candidate who takes money from corporations and their lobbyists and the PACs that launder that money. I have pledged as an independent Green candidate to accept no donations from corporations, corporate executives, corporate lobbyists, and so I aim to be a voice for the people of Maine in the U.S. Senate. I'm just retiring from 25 years of teaching school in low-income rural Maine, and I have seen, even before the pandemic, the families of the children that I work with struggling to survive in an economy that has thrown them under the bus while CEO salaries have gone through the roof. Most of these families are hardworking and they care for their children and they do their best, but they are one accident or illness away from the collapse of their economic arrangements. Now that the pandemic has set in, school was canceled, people are struggling to pay the rent and keep food on the table. I think that the pandemic didn't create these conditions, but it has shown a light on the stark income inequality in our country and here in the state of Maine. And I aim to go to the Senate and be a voice for the people. I've been organizing around climate justice and particularly calling attention to the effects of the military on climate for many years here. I've been engaged in a coalition waging a conversion campaign, asking that our industrial capacity be repurposed to build solutions to climate crisis rather than building weapon systems that exacerbate climate crisis. I also favor a $15 minimum wage, solving the student debt crisis so that the young people can, you know, start their lives and start a family, build a house, and complete their educations without being burdened with debt for the rest of their lives. I do support expanded, improved Medicare for all, a universal single-payer healthcare system, such as all the other wealthy nations have. We've seen how important that leadership could have been to have a national health service at the helm during this pandemic, and how much the U.S. has floundered as because we lack that kind of system. And I call for a demilitarized Green New Deal because, as my fellow candidates here have mentioned, without defunding the Pentagon and without a fair tax on the wealthy, we will not be able to find the money for any of these social programs. However, the savings in a Medicare for all program would be approximately 30%, it looks like. And the Pentagon really, at this point, gets about 70% of the discretionary federal budget each year. It shows on the books as maybe 54 or 55%, but they hide all the nuclear weapons in the Energy Department budget line. And also the Veterans Administration is its own budget line. I'm certainly not in favor of defunding the Veterans Administration, but I do think we need a realistic accounting of exactly how much American taxpayers devote to the military project each year. Obviously, I'm very pro-education. I think that education, public education, has been underfunded my entire lifetime, and I would like to see free public higher education as well. I don't think that students should be graduating from a state university with a mountain of debt. So I thank the Green Party very much for your support and for your time today. We're in it to win it. And under ranked choice voting, we really have a shot at electing a senator for people, planet, and peace. Our website is lisafermaine.org. So check us out, and we'd love to have you on the team. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to all our candidates. And now there's an opportunity for any press in the room. Just raise your hand and we'll call on you to ask a question to any or all of our candidates.
That's you can call me anything besides late for dinner. I was wondering about Miss Savage. You have ranked choice voting in Maine, and that's magnificent. Considering, would you be willing to endorse the Democrat as the second your second choice in the fall election, considering, you know, that Susan Collins is still kind of running first in the polls, and we need to get rid of her as soon as is humanly possible?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I certainly would consider endorsing the Democratic candidate, whoever that may be, as a second choice. It remains to be seen exactly who's going to be on the ballot, though, because there's another independent candidate who is suing for ballot access because of the pandemic. Tiffany Bond, an independent, was unable to gather the requisite number of signatures. And so if her lawsuit is successful, she would also be on the ballot. There's another independent who's to the right of Susan Collins. So it's entirely possible that I will endorse some candidate as the number two or even number three choice. Ranked choice voting is interesting. I live in the second district of Maine, which is the more rural, poorer part of Maine with less population, and ranked choice voting unseated Bruce Poliquin there as our representative in Congress because Tiffany Bond and another independent ran strong enough that the second choice votes of the people that picked them first went to the Democrat. And so now Jared Golden, the Democrat, represents this district. So it's definitely a consideration. Thanks for that question.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I'm Mike Gams. I'm representing the Justice League of Queers right now, which is a online queer anarchist media collective. And I guess I had a question for all three candidates. I know that both of our presidential candidates have addressed this issue before, but I wanted to ask all of y'all whether or not you support the federal decriminalization of sex work, and particularly such as repealing SESTA-FOSTA, which are legislation that the sex work community have been advocating against. So thank you.
Well, I can say that, you know, I know that with sex workers, there's a concern for their health and safety and well-being when what is being done is illegal, because they have they're living in the shadows. They can't reach out to have the resources that they might need to get adequate attention to their if they're being abused, if they have disease, and they're afraid of being arrested. So in general, I'm not extremely familiar with a particular legislation you mentioned. I'm not familiar with it, but I would be interested in learning about it. And I mean, if you want to reach out to me at justin@justinforall.org, I could try to come up with a more comprehensive response. But in general, yes, I can at least say that I'm sympathetic to the plight of sex workers who are in that difficult position and suffering health consequences.
Thank you, Justin. Any other candidates?
I'll happily weigh in on this. I would echo what Justin said. Personally, there are a lot of troubling stories of, you see, human trafficking, that the catalyst is sex work, and there's definitely a need for decriminalizing this, because it is a black market situation where there's no regulation. And so, yeah, ultimately I would say I'd like to decriminalize sex work. But in regards to the second, I think you had a specific policy or proposal that you were raising. Would you mind going into that a little deeper?
Okay. So SESTA FOSTA is two different bills that were pushed forth in early 2019, mostly led by Kamala Harris. And they were these bills that were designed to look like they were ending sex trafficking, but what they actually did was take away safe spaces for sex workers to particularly online. So they shut down things like back pages and other online resources where sex workers could have a place to like safe spaces and places that they could work. And they shut down these services under the guise of protecting against sex trafficking, but it was actually did more harm to the sex work community than help. But
gotcha. It was a bait and switch. Okay. Yeah. So I think it would be better to have a genuine bill showing exactly what it does and how it helps people.
Thank you.
Yes, I do support decriminalization of sex work. I think that I stand with workers, and work is work. I also feel that criminalizing things that are not appropriately under the purview of the criminal justice system is a huge problem in our country. The mass incarceration crisis is enormous, and now it's a health crisis as well. Certainly, we would want legislation that would protect vulnerable people from being trafficked for sex, but I appreciate your enlightening us a little bit about those two bills. Thank you.
Lots of folks keep saying ever since Hillary rigged the nomination of our plutocratic party that there's a lesser evil, that it supposedly is her. When asked to demonstrate this, then they're not so sure. But if they look at the records of the parties they come from, it looks very much to me like a game of zero sum. Both parties love the army and want to arm it more. Both parties voted to start the Iraq war. Both parties push for treaties that benefit the rich. Both parties let the banksters get off without a hitch. Both parties deport migrants, the Democrats especially. Neither party wants to take many refugees. Both parties vote for crime bills that put the poor in jail. Both are mostly led by rich white males. So I just see two evil people putting on a puppet show. If one of them is lesser, I certainly don't know. Drone strikes, they both think drones are great. Both parties hold fundraisers for $1,000 a plate. Both parties love the pipelines, both parties love the frack. Both parties run police departments that kill you if you're black. Both parties love corruption, for that is how they're run. They both take banksters' money to make sure nothing will get done. So I just see two evil people putting on a puppet show. If one of them is lesser, I certainly don't know.
parties serve the wealthy. Both parties say they don't. Both parties say they'll improve things, but the other party won't. Both parties have supporters that make me want to spew. And with each election cycle, it's all that I can do. Not to strangle someone who thinks they know the score. That one is the lesser evil, that's the one we should vote for. I just see two evil people putting on a puppet show. If one of them is lesser, I certainly don't know.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm Margaret Flowers. I'm one of the outgoing national chairs of the co-chairs of the Green Party of the United States. Today, July 11th, 2020, we have just concluded our Green Party presidential nominating convention. Our first time having a virtual convention due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we got through it happily without too many glitches. And we successfully nominated a vice president and presidential candidate for the 2020 election, Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker, with almost 60% of the delegates in our competition that had a pretty wide field. So very exciting to have that result and have them representing us as the president and vice presidential candidates today. Our national spokesperson, Trehearne Cruz, I don't think is able to make it. He was having some difficulties technically. If he joins us, we can invite him to say a few words, but I think that we should move in to the candidates. This is why you're here. And what I'll do is introduce Howie and Angela. We'll ask them to say a few words and then we'll open it up to questions. And if you'd like to ask a question, please do use the raise your hand feature. You'll find that if you click on the participants icon at the bottom of the screen, if you move your cursor to the bottom, you'll find that and you'll find the raise hand feature. If you're not able to do that, please don't hesitate to unmute yourself. And when there's a pause, speak up and say that you'd like to ask a question. So I see that Erica has already raised his hand. That's great. So you're first in line. So let me introduce Angela first and ask you to say a few words, then I'll introduce Howie. So Angela Walker is an independent socialist who describes herself as a Fred Hampton, Asada Shakur socialist. She was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to a working class Black family. She learned early that though money was necessary to live in this society, it was less important than integrity, cooperation, and dignity. This upbringing shaped the activist and organizer that she became, and you can read her full bio, an excellent bio. She's a mother and a grandmother and a truck driver at the howiehawkins.us website. So Angela, would you like to make a few comments?
Hey, good afternoon to everybody. I am really, really excited right now. I'm very, very grateful for the delegates and their support. I'm grateful for how well this conference went. It was very, very well done. And I want the folks who put it together to know that, and I think I speak for Howie when I say this, they did an excellent, excellent job. So thank y'all for, you know, making that happen. And also thank y'all, you know, everyone who's currently present. Thank you for being here.
Great, thank you for that, Angela. Let me now introduce Howie Hawkins. Howie Hawkins is the original Green New Dealer, the first US candidate to campaign for a Green New Deal in 2010. He's also one of the original Greens in the United States, having participated in the first national meeting to organize the Green Party of the United States in St. Paul, Minnesota in August of 1984. Hawkins became active in the movement for civil rights and against the war in Vietnam as a teenager. He is a lifelong activist, a member of the working class, and a scholar and a socialist. And you can also read his full and impressive bio at howiehawkins.us. Howie?
Thank you. And I want to second again Angela's thanks to the people that put on the convention. I know those people got a lot of grief, a lot of pressure, and they pulled it off beautifully. And I know they worked hard. So, you know, all thanks to them, as well as the Green parties around the country that hold together, you know, these primaries in difficult circumstances on the fly as the COVID lockdown happened. You know, what it means, I talked about in my speech, how we're living in a failed state. The two-party corporate state has failed. And I went through five life or death issues. The COVID pandemic, the racism pandemic, the climate crisis, inequality, in a new nuclear arms race. And I think the Greens just showed by pulling off this convention, hey, you know, like we said, let's put a couple of workers up there in the White House in place of those grifters. We'll put a better class of people up in there. Angela and I know, unlike Trump, who says he knows everything about everything and knows nothing about anything that matters, we know what we don't know and where we need help, and we will get it. So I just think at that level alone, you know, we showed, the first time I was ever quoted on national network was when we occupied Seabrook and we had a demonstration in support of those in the National Guard armies. And I blurted out, the Clamshell Alliance is better organized than the state of New Hampshire. And we were. I think we can do a better job than these two old parties we've been up in there and failing on. They can't solve anything. So those are my opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Howie and Angela. So now we'll take some questions. And could you please identify yourself with your name and your media outlet? And the first is Eric. And
very good. Thank you. Two quick questions are, Howie, you were there at the beginning of the Green Party decades and decades ago. Has the party progressed in the way that you would have foreseen, or are things going a lot slower than you expected? That's question one, a perspective question. And then question two is, how are you going to campaign? Are you going to be focusing on specific states? Are you going to be 100% social media? I mean, what is your plan for campaigning? Those are my two questions. Thank you.
You know, I really didn't have an expectation. I've been in so many movements where we've been in a minority, sometimes for decades. Usually not that long. I mean, when we started protesting the Vietnam War in 65, 66, and 67, we were a small, vilified minority. And then after the Tet Offensive, people flipped. I mean, I grew up in a community with a lot of auto workers, and those guys were World War II veterans, very patriotic. And then they began having their doubts, but suddenly, just like a school of fish suddenly makes a turn another way, they all came out against the war. And I've been through that in so many movements. And that's the way I look at this. You know, when you're in these struggles, all you need, and there's a great Debs quote I can't recall right now. I said, but all you need to be at peace with is your own evaluation of what's right. And then whatever the circumstances, you're going to be all right. And then, you know, the thing is you lose until you win. And I think that's the way we look at it. So, you know, I really didn't have a timeline. And, you know, we're up against the world's second most enthusiastic capitalist party, as a conservative once called the Democratic Party, and the world's most enthusiastic capitalist party, the Republicans. And they're the two richest parties, and the Democrats are the oldest party. And we're in a political system unlike any other electoral democracy that tries to keep third parties off the ballot. So we have a lot of obstacles. But here we are 35 years later, and we are the independent left voice on the ballot. And it's there if there's an independent left in this country, if it finally figures out that, you know, working inside the Democratic Party is a way, you know, you don't change the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party changes you. You know, Bernie Sanders showed us. He got elected to mayor of Burlington and the Congress member from Vermont and then a senator from Vermont running as an independent. And then he ran as a Democrat and the establishment cut him off. So the lesson there is run as an independent. We can win. How are we going to campaign this election? Well, we say every state is a battleground state for the Green Party. You know, what they call battlegrounds like Ohio and Pennsylvania, for the Green Party members in those states, there are no Democrats helping them fight fracking and fossil fuel infrastructure. In Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, the Democrats helping the Green Party fight Enbridge Line 5, which goes across the northern parts of those states, a lot of it on native land. Very few Democrats, particularly any Democrats up north. It's the Green Party, and those are battleground states. And in every state, when we're fighting affordable housing, it's usually we're fighting the Democratic machine, which is financed by the real estate industry that is more interested in upscale housing than affordable housing. So, you know, we find we're on the other side of the Democrats in every state. And there's no way we're going to abandon the Greens in Pennsylvania fighting fracking or the Greens in Philly fighting for affordable housing just because it's a battleground state. A friend of mine, Akili Kali Akuno, down in Mississippi, we were talking about this, and he said, yeah, the Democrats want us to give them sacrifice zones. We're not doing that. So we're going to fight for every vote in every state.
Thank you, Howie. Angela, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Just thinking about how we're going to campaign. I think our campaign is going to continue in the way that most things are continuing in this country. Everybody's going to have to, we're going to have to be flexible. We're going to have to be creative. And, you know, of course, you know, Howie and I both agree that nothing, there's nothing like a face-to-face conversation with people where you can, you know, there's that energy exchange that happens. When I think there's going to be opportunities that where it is safe for both us and for the people that we want to interact with, if that can happen, it will happen. I think a lot of things are still going to be virtual, a lot of social media, things like that, but we're going to be very creative with this campaign as much as possible.
Thank you. Next, let's go to Rebecca McCarthy. And Rebecca, if you could please state which outlet you're with, that would be great.
Thanks very much. I'm with a small magazine that's launching. It's from a former editor at Long Reads. It's called The End of the World Review. It's a newsletter. But congratulations to both of you, Howie and Angela. Those were great speeches. I was wondering, as far as like your vision of a Green Deal, if there was a way you differentiate yourself from what the Sanders campaign put forward, especially like what your feelings on carbon capture and storage were, because I know they were really trying to stay away from that because they just saw that as a like a ploy for the oil industry to continue operating. I was wondering if you shared that opinion.
I think Bernie Sanders was the only Democrat with a serious proposal. Wasn't as good as ours. He was going to get to zero emissions by 2050, but it was ambitious enough that he wanted to get the power and transportation sectors to zero emissions by 2030. He was $16.3 trillion over 10 years, we're $27.5 trillion. And we looked at his numbers and we figured the reason for the difference is he was getting manufacturing, agriculture, and buildings to zero emissions by 2050. So it's a slower pace. He also did at least the power through the public sector, Federal Energy Administration, which we think is essential to make the rapid transition. We got to do public enterprise and planning to basically make this happen in a decade. So And he pointed out, which we agree, that, you know, how are you going to pay for it? Well, we're going to have to borrow money, invest up front. We're going to have to reprioritize the federal budget and tax the rich more. But that's a good investment. And in the long run, it will pay off. As he pointed out with energy, we're talking about public housing units, transportation fares, energy, leasing, Green New Deal factories, the worker cooperatives, and other sources of revenue. Like any good business investment, it pays for itself once it starts generating revenue. So he had that piece. So that was all good. It was just a little slower than ours. As far as carbon capture goes, that's where Biden is. He has no right to call what he's talking about a Green New Deal. I mean, he wants to keep fracking the hell out of the country, powering electricity with natural gas, too slow phase out of gasoline engines for vehicles. And then he wants to capture the carbon out of these gas power plants with a technology that is not yet proven economical. And then you got to pump the carbon underground. So we're not for that. We can do solar and wind and other renewable sources of energy that are clean. We do want to draw carbon out of the atmosphere, but that's where our Green New Deal has a 4 million person strong civilian conservation corps to plant forests, to rebuild soils, to restore habitat, particularly carbon-intensive habitat like wetlands and mangroves and that kind of thing. And so we are concerned. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I, you know, said at a conservative estimate in my speech, they basically assumed that mid-century we're going to have a way of drawing carbon out of the atmosphere with technologies that haven't been proven. We got to start that now, because even if we get to zero emissions, we're going to keep emitting carbon. Like the oceans absorb carbon, and it's going to be emitting carbon for centuries, you know, from all the industrial era carbon that was absorbed by the ocean. So, you know, that's a serious problem. But we're not talking about burning fossil fuels and grabbing the carbon and putting it in the ground. Mm-hmm. That is uneconomical and is going to get us down the wrong path. That's not a bridge to the future, that's a bridge off a cliff.
Great. Angela, would you like to add anything to that?
No, I think Howie's pretty comprehensive with it.
Okay, great. Next up, I have David Rockello. Let's get you unmuted. And if you could please state which media outlet you're with.
Hi, David Rockello from killradio.org. Congratulations to the two candidates. What I'd like to know is your media strategy. How are you going to get onto those Sunday shows, Amanpour and Company, and other petroleum corporate media? How are you going to get out there so we can all see you on regular television? In addition, I just want to say again, congratulations and all the best.
Well, I'll say briefly, we'll keep, like I did in my speech, calling them out for being state media stenographers for the two-party corporate state. And if they're real journalists, professional journalists, you know, we do know they're reporters and hosts of some of these shows that want us, but higher up, the editors, the producers, and higher up probably in their corporate hierarchy, they say no. So we're gonna call them out and expose them and shame them. We're getting covered by German, Indian, Spanish, Moroccan, Australian, Russian. I mean, everybody in the world's covering us but the damn American media. So let's just shame them and hopefully they got some sense of conscience. I don't know what your thoughts are, Angela.
Basically the same thing, and it's really funny that you said that, because one of the things that my aunt was yelling at me about is, y'all need to get on media in this country, and if they won't cover you, go around the world. That's basically what we're ending up doing. And so, you know, just continuing to reach out to domestic media outlets. I mean, I've, you know, done pretty well with speaking with, you know, much smaller audiences, but as far as like getting to, you know, like you said, the Sunday stuff, we're just like how we say, go out to shame them. It's like everyone is talking to us but you. Everyone in the world knows about this campaign but you. What do you look like?
Hi, my name's Kevin Zeese. I'm Howie's and Angela's press secretary. So let me comment on this question a little bit. What we're doing already in this campaign is developing a grassroots network of activists working with the campaign to spread the word. When we get some media coverage, these activists will put it out on social media and let people know it's happening so that we magnify our impact. Howie has already been on in the Hill magazine twice. He's been on Hill TV Rising, which is has a very large audience of 600,000 viewers. And it's a lot of ex-Sanders people, because one of the hosts is a burner. And he's been on a bunch of big podcasts. The media scene has changed a lot. Already, Howie and Angela have reached probably hundreds of thousands of voters through podcasts and independent media. And we have a very strong social media team. And I think, as Angela and Howie said, we have to shame them. And one way you shame them is you have a network of word that so the whole world knows you exist, and the media loses credibility by not covering you. They already have a credibility problem. And if they don't cover something people know about, Howie was on C-SPAN this morning, he'll be on C-SPAN again tonight. So that's millions of viewers right there. And so the corporate media will have no choice. You know, when we organized the Occupy movement back in 2010, 2011, we didn't send a press release to the corporate media because we knew that if they covered us, they would cover us unfairly, and that our job, we did this, that we listed a lot of independent media, people's media, and this is a people's campaign. When that people's media covered Occupy, the corporate media had no choice but to cover it and to cover it honestly. And that's what we're going to do here as well. It's a bottom-up campaign, grassroots, media power, people power is what's going to get us in the corporate media as well. Oh, one more point, and Howie didn't mention this, but we're also challenging the uber capitalist Donald Trump to a lifelong socialist, Howie Hawkins. Let's see if this capitalist is a coward or if he has the courage to actually debate a socialist. We're gonna make that challenge very public and see what kind of player Donald Trump is. He may think he can beat Hawkins in a debate, he can't. And so we're gonna make that debate challenge very aggressively. Over.
And also clarify that Trump's got the wrong guy he's calling a socialist. It's not Joe Biden.
This is David Rocchiello, Kill Radio. Got a little flustered. I forgot to ask, what's your plan? And I'd like to hear from Angela first this time. What's your plan to get all those Bernie supporters, like the people from the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, those undecided socialists,
speak to them about issues, which is a lot of what has been happening, actually, where people are undecided. It's particularly on my social media and more on my Twitter than anything else. But people are undecided, people are disillusioned, people are, you know, they need somewhere to be, and they need a home, they need representation, and just speaking with them about issues and letting them know that if you were someone who supported Bernie Sanders, you supported him for reasons. One of those big reasons is Medicare for all. And so when we lay out, you know, I discuss our full strength, basically, Medicare for all, which is a community-controlled national health service versus having, you know, private administrators, you know, putting their hands in it, which makes it, you know, something that is accountable to the people who are using it. It just reminds them, okay, well, you know, you are... y'all, the policies that you are putting forth are the ones that I still support. And, you know, it's just speaking to people about issues is pretty much the way that I've been handling that.
Yeah, we are going to Bernie Sanders groups like Our Revolution and others, and, you know, DSA local chapters. The national committee's made it clear they're not going to endorse in the presidential race. But, you know, this is the old strategy, United Front from below. You go talk to the rank and file, and some of the organized groups are responding positively, others are not, but there's a discussion going on. And of course, you know, our basic argument to those people is, I say don't get lost in the sauce. You vote for Biden, and everything you stood for with Sanders disappears because you voted for Biden. You didn't vote for Medicare for all, you voted for Biden. You vote for the Greens, you're voting for Medicare for all. And the other good things that Bernie Sanders stood for. So, you know, don't silence yourself. Make yourself heard in this election. Don't waste your vote. Vote for the Greens.
Next, we'll go to Mike Feinstein.
Hi, everybody. Mike Feinstein, political columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and my Southern California colleague before David Rocchiello did already ask you about how to get more media, which was a direction I was going to go in as well. And let me phrase it this way. Howie made a very passionate appeal during his acceptance speech about why media should cover this campaign based on the issues. And then Angela talked about how dynamic it is to be talking to people in person. I'm wondering whether this campaign is thinking about cutting and pasting that couple minutes from the convention speech and doing things like tweeting it out to individual journalists around the country. We're normally used to the press release that we send out, and then we don't hear from them, and we wonder why they don't respond to our press releases. And we're in a different era today. So does this party and this campaign think about maybe using media strategies like that to reach journalists and to reach their hearts? Over.
Yeah, we do. You just gave us a good idea. And we're trying to reach the media, the political reporters. We've got a list of them around the country, and we're hitting them with news releases, but also tweets and other social media. And I read books, so I'm not the guy that can tell you how we do that, but we got these young guys that Kevin was talking about, and young men and women that are, you know, getting the word out. And so that's definitely part of our media strategy.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, something that you know, I'll tweet something and like my followers pick it up, and you know, they tag news outlets and things like that too. So yeah, that's an excellent idea.
Great. Next we have Mike Gams. Please state what outlet you're with.
Hey, thank you. I'm Mike Ames. I'm here today representing the Justice League of Queers, which is an online queer anarchist media collective with over 20,000 followers online. And we're part of a larger network of queer radical leftist shit posters on the internet, including other pages like Fully Automated Luxury Gay Space Communism and I'm Here, I'm Queer, and the Bourgeoisie Should Live in Fear. Our follower base is made up of a lot of people that aren't in the Green Party, particularly queer people who felt that Bernie was the compromise, right? He was the compromise because he voted in favor of things like Cesta Fosta, which is an attack on sex workers, and sanctions in Venezuela, and things like that. So I guess I have a two-part question. First, what I guess would be for Angela, what are you doing to help show that this campaign and this party is a safe space for queers, particularly ones who've never been involved with the Green Party before? And I guess for Howie, for those people who feel that Bernie was the compromise, what are you doing to show that we don't need to compromise?
Well, to answer your question, hey, Mike, I identify as queer. And so I, one of the biggest, most important things with this campaign is, as I said in my acceptance speech, that this, our party needs to be a flourishing and welcoming space for all of us along the LGBTQIA rainbow and all of those places where we intersect with race, with gender expression or non, with physical ability or different ability, all of those things. Age, everything that we bring into it. And being vocal about that, being very intentional in our chapters, in our spaces, places where we come together, and making sure that we are aware of who is in the room. We are talking through, you know, places where people may feel uncomfortable. Because there's a lot of people, you know, particularly in, you know, certain places where they're not used to being around diversity. And, you know, we've got folks in our party who, you know, have been doing things a certain way for a very long time. And it's going to call for us to be compassionate. It's going to call for us to be curious in a good way. And I mean that in like the yogic way versus, you know, the kind of morbid curiosity where you want to poke at things, not that. So it's going to call for us to just be open-hearted. And I know that sounds like really touchy-feely and squishy, but I think if there is a time that we've ever lived in that really demands compassion, this is it. And so I think that we are just going to have to, as a party, be willing to be open-minded and to understand that this is a party that has to be, because no one else is doing what we're doing. No one else is bringing the message that we're bringing. And if we are talking about the world that we want to create, we have to start right here. I mean, it starts with self, and then it starts with our party. We can't put this into the larger world if we are not doing this within our party. And so, just making sure that we are meeting people where they are, and we are doing so with open minds and open hearts and sincerity, because I don't play that, oh, I tolerate. You can keep that. This is not about tolerance. Either we're going to be comrades or we're not. So that's where I am with that.
Well, I don't think I'm the compromise like Bernie was. We go way beyond Bernie, particularly on foreign and military policy. I mean, he didn't want to deal with that. He was kind of tone deaf on racial justice issues, wouldn't touch reparations for African Americans. And that's so obvious. You know, as I mentioned in my speech, you just do the last 10 years, Black America lost half its wealth because these corporate criminals were stealing people's homes. And two of them are in the Trump administration. That's Mnuchin in Treasury and Wilbur Ross in the Commerce Department. You know, he was at the center of the robo-signing of computerized fraud to steal people's homes. And the Obama administration didn't prosecute them. And people want to tell us that we ought to stand aside for the Democrats to get rid of Trump. You know, what was the reason we're supposed to vote for the Democrats again? They couldn't even fight these people that were stealing people's homes. So, yeah, there's a lot there. You mentioned Venezuela. You know, we should lift the sanctions on Venezuela. They're in trouble. You know, their oil industry's not working. They're dealing with a COVID pandemic. There's all kinds of problems. Let's be a humanitarian power instead of a bully, you know, telling them who their president should be like we got a right to. And it's not just Bernie. It's the whole damn Democratic Party. When Trump put Guaido up there in the gallery at the State of the Union address and then gave him his props, every video I've seen is every Democrat was giving him a standing ovation like every Republican. You know, that is like U.S. imperialism, bipartisan, right in front of your eyes. And then the sex work question. We're for decriminalization on a New Zealand model so that both the person purchasing the sex and the person getting paid for the sex or whatever the service is, it's not criminal. It's between consenting adults. You still want to go after trafficking and, you know, underage and so forth. But we're not talking about the Nordic model where the person receiving the money isn't prosecuted, but the person giving the money is, which brings the person who's delivering the service into the criminal justice system anyway. And that's a BS solution. So that's where we stand on that. And Bernie, you know, I think when it comes to the social issues, he's a little bit shy of really deciding. You know, the way we decide things is what's good for the people, what's right, not what's popular. I mean, the Democrats are known as a socially liberal party, but how did they move on gay marriage? They chased public opinion on that one. It was the Green Party that led. It was Jason West and Rebecca Rotzler in New Paltz that started marrying couples in 2003. And it was the Democratic Attorney General that got an injunction against them. They called him the Sheriff of Wall Street, Elliot Spitzer, the big liberal. Turns out he was paying for sex with a credit card. He got caught. I mean, the arrogance of that guy just to set himself up like that. Man, oh, man. So anyway, like I said, you know, Angela and I are working people. We'll put a better class of people up there in the White House and bring some common sense.
Great. Thank you. Next, we have Monty Letourneau. And let me get you unmuted. And please state what media outlet you're with.
With no commercial affiliation, I call it the All Insane Green Party Critical Partisan Tattletales Brigade. And I kind of have a two-part. First of all, I haven't heard much about Palestine today. And I'd like to have you, preferably both of you, just quick comment on the general situation there. But really, I have a statement I want to ask you to comment on. In my opinion, for a couple of years now, I'm very much getting in the habit of saying we've crossed all the tipping points. I'm getting very sick of professionals, scientists, science reporters, even Jill Stein, referring to things I have pretty much made my peace with are behind us as in the future tense. And so I just want to lay out the general concept that models have frequently predicted for 2050, something that happens a couple years later. 2015, we hit the 2050, published in 2013 by the UN for acidification of the ocean. Granted, we came up with a better way to measure it as well. But we've got tundra burning and melting and releasing gas at a much faster rate than we know. We've got fracking, cracking open the earth and leaking its gas out much faster than I think we have any idea. And now the Gulf Coast stream is bumping up as it disperses, bumping up against the steepest continental shelves off the fjords where the most serious methane hydrate deposits are.
Monty, can you kind of wrap up your point, please?
In terms of the gravity of that situation, any comments? I know, I'm not being nice, but I'm also concerned.
Well, I'll start.
Go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, I was just gonna say on the climate models, you know, you're basically right. The climate scientists come up with a model and then they check and they find out we're headed toward disaster faster. And part of that is that the scientific community tends to be conservative, tries to stay out of politics, particularly with this international or intergovernmental panel on climate change, because their studies got to get approved by the petrol states before they're released. And so they tend to go on the conservative side. The best science is being done by people, you know, like Kevin Anderson at the Tisdale Center and Schellenbacher, I think, or Berger in the Potsdam Center, and even James Hansen and his people that were at NASA and now at Columbia. Their predictions have been better than the International Panel on Climate Change. But even they're getting surprised, because the thing they worry about are those tipping points where you get a positive feedback, where the more it happens, the worse it gets. Like the tundra melting, you reach that point, then the methane and the carbon is released into the atmosphere, which heats it up faster, then more tundra melts, and you're in this vicious cycle. And looks like we're hitting those. Like the solar ice cap, the snow reflects heat, the dark ocean absorbs it. And, you know, we have almost ice-free summers up there now, or we're getting there very close, which is a positive feedback loop, a vicious circle. So we have, you know, that's why we're saying, no, don't wait till 2050, a decade. I mean, engineers tell us it's gonna take a decade to build all this stuff under the best of circumstances. Well, that's what we gotta try to do. And no model can accurately predict. The better we do, the better we'll be protected. But we're in trouble. And then on Palestine, you know, until the Palestinian people's rights are respected by the state of Israel, I believe we got to start doing like we did against South African apartheid, start imposing sanctions. And the National BDS Committee in Palestine says the next thing we need to do is start pulling military aid. And the question immediately, which could be a trigger for that, is if Israel goes ahead with its plan to annex all the settlements on the West Bank. But if they don't do that formally, they've already done it practically. And so I think that it's a terrible situation, and the U.S. should stop giving Israel a blank check to do whatever the hell it wants to the Palestinians. That's just an immoral position that we cannot abide.
As far as Palestine goes, I'm a Black American. I understand what it is to live under a state that treats you like a second-class citizen. And so one of the things that the Movement for Black Lives has always done is express its solidarity with Palestine. And that is, as Howie said, our position as well with our campaign, and thinking that, you know, sanctions need to be imposed against Israel in the way that they were against South Africa to end the apartheid and to show that we support that. So that's one thing. And as far as what you were talking about with the environment, I think one of the things that you were looking for is a sense of urgency, that for us, this thing is immediate. Climate grief is real. And frankly, we don't have time to, you know, sit and tinker around in the way that, the two parties will. Basically the one party, because the Republicans don't even talk about it, but we don't have any time to be playing with this. This is immediate, and this is part of the reason that we need to get this out here.
Great. Next we have Ann Garrison, and Ann, if you can state which media outlet you're with, please.
I'm with Pacifica Radio, most often KPFA Radio, although we've been doing a national broadcast called COVID-19 Race and Democracy recently. Also the Black Agenda Report and several other text publications. I have one domestic question and one about foreign policy, and then probably a few sub questions. With regard to domestic policy, for years, we've heard just enormous emphasis on diversity. And the Democratic Party has made identity politics and racial and gender diversity its banner. But I've never heard anyone make an argument, as you seem to do, for representation of the working class being part of the diversity that's needed in politics. I want to applaud that and ask you to say something further about it and about how you'll try to get that point across, to expand the idea of diversity to include the working class.
Well, I would say, and we got this written down somewhere, you know, we're not just about diversity, we're about equality. You can sprinkle in some black faces in high places and some other marginalized groups and keep a very unequal system in place where the masses of black people and other marginalized people stay oppressed and exploited. And the Democrats, that's their game. They sort of have this meritocratic system. Well, you know, Barack Obama made it, Susan Rice made it. If you didn't make it, well, that's your own damn fault. Go back to school. That is the subtext to the Democrats, you know, sort of meritocratic standard. That's why their base, their mass base is the professional managerial class. And they don't really know how to talk to the working class. That's why the working class stay home and don't vote, because Hillary Clinton epitomized that. A lot of working class people, she looked to them like that suit at Human Relations. When you're injured and you go in there and say, I need workers' comp, and they say, no, we're not gonna get that to you. Go get disability. You got that insurance, which pays half as much as the workers' comp would. You know, that's the kind of person they see there. That's what the Democratic Party looks like to a lot of working class people. So we need to talk about equality, not just diversity. And that's within, you know, the identities that people organize around to overcome their oppression. That's, you know, and then the class question, of course. We want to do away with, you know, basically do away with classes. You know, everybody should, you know, when they work, they should get the full fruit of their labor, but there shouldn't be a group of people that's living off the labor of other people. That's called exploitation. Whether it's slavery, feudalism, capitalism, we're not for that.
Go ahead. Gonna chime in that thinking about the fact that the working class makes up most of this country. And people, one of the things that I've heard from people in talking to them, even before I ever thought of running for office or anything like that, how many times have you heard people say, we need somebody who understands, we need someone in the White House or someone highly placed to make legislation that understands truly what it is to be us. And so I think one of the most valuable things about this campaign, I still drive a truck. Howie is a retired worker. We know what it is to have to live day to day earning a paycheck. We know what it is, especially with my, you know, the work that I do. I am affected by climate change. When I live in South Carolina, when we have a tropical storm come through here and we're dumping inches and inches of rain, that means I don't work. I don't get paid for that. So this is a very, very real thing to me. You know, the things that we're looking at facing, you know, where folks in this country are facing evictions and, you know, going without medical insurance, these are things that we know about, that we can speak to. It's not some vicarious, you know, experience that we cite that somebody else had. This is something we know intimately. And I think that's one of the values that we bring to this.
Okay, can I go on to my foreign policy question? Mm-hmm. Okay, in 2016, I spoke to Edward S. Herman, the late great Edward S. Herman, the co-author with Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent. And he departed from his co-author, Noam Chomsky, quite significantly. And he has done that consistently, excuse me. And the difference is that Chomsky says we have to vote for the lesser evil. Edward S. Herman said that he would do what Kant had said, which is do what you would have generalized, and particularly that the Green Party is necessary to articulate a foreign policy alternative to that of the Democrats and the Republicans, which is more or less the same, although the Democrats is at times seems to be even worse. So can you tell me how you would do that? Articulate an alternative foreign policy.
Well, basically, we want to end the U.S. global military empire. You know, we want relations with other countries that are based on equality under international law. We want to use diplomacy rather than arms to resolve conflicts. And that means getting out of these, there's seven endless wars we're now involved in, withdrawing from over 800 foreign military bases, cutting the military budget way down, and going to other countries. We may not like their governmental systems, but we got to deal with them as they are. You know, climate change. You know, China and Russia, like Trump's America, are big problems in terms of fossil fuels extraction and use. And, you know, we need to get with them if we're going to solve this problem we were just talking about. And then we got this nuclear arms race. I mean, nothing else matters if we don't stop that before we blow ourselves up. And we're lucky to still be here. I mean, I've read a recent book by Daniel Ellsberg and another one by Fred Kaplan and an older one by Scott Ritter. Man, we are so lucky to still be here. And nobody's talking about this. You know, none of the presidential candidates, they don't have a program for it. You know, Biden, the lesser evil, was participant in the nuclear modernization program initiated under Obama and continued under Trump, which now other countries have responded to, Russia, China, India. And they're changing their nuclear doctrines. I mean, China and India had a policy of no first use. Now they're saying with these hypersonic strategic nukes, maybe we can't afford that because we might have to launch before we get launched on, because those nukes are so fast, you can't wait for a sign on your radar. I mean, we're in a big mess, and we need a totally different direction. So I'm with Ed Herman on that. You know, Chomsky's argued that lesser evil thing for a long time. And, you know, the classic case, the lesser evil opens the door to the greater evil. The socialists in Germany supported a conservative, von Hindenburg, to stop Hitler. And they got what they wanted. Hindenburg won, and then he appointed Hitler chancellor. We can't rely on the Democrats to fight the right or militarism. And so I think Edward Herman was right and Chomsky was wrong on that question.
Could you bring agriculture at this point? A lot of people are afraid of supply chain collapse and hunger. And suddenly I know a lot of people trying to grow food in their backyard or the porch. And this morning I did a story about the quote unquote green agricultural revolution that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have forced on Africa. It's been a disaster. Could you expand on what a better and more humanistic environmental foreign policy would mean with regard to global agriculture?
Well, in a lot of these foreign policy things, our best way of being effective in moving other countries is to set a good example ourselves. So how can we tell other countries about human rights when we have the largest prison system in the history of the world? And with this war on drugs, it's been a war on black and brown communities. And we know from the confessions of John Ehrlichman to Harper's Magazine back in the 90s that was the whole strategy of the Nixon administration. The war on drugs was a war on black people and a war on the anti-war movement. They go after the anti-war movement for weed, and they go after the black people for heroin, and they knew it was all a lie. Ehrlichman said so. It was a political ploy. And so how can we turn around and talk about human rights abroad? Same with agriculture. Our agriculture is industrialized and corporatized. Our Green New Deal agricultural policy will get the corporations out, de-industrialize agriculture, go to regenerative organic agriculture, which means we got to put working farmers on the land, not corporations, absentee owners. It means we got to subsidize the transition away from biocides and chemical fertilizers. It means we need parity pricing for all agricultural commodities, not just the big ones like corn and soy, but all the fruits and vegetables and the dairy products, so that farmers who are engaged in organic practices are assured of an income above their cost of living. And then we need supply management programs so you're not getting, you know, boom and bust in prices because of gluts or shortages. So if we can do that, then we can say, hey, you know, here's how we can help you in other countries. Right now, we use our trade policy. Look what we did to Mexico. Their ejido system gave a lot of people access to the public land. They had the right of use. And under NAFTA, that land was privatized, and agribusiness went in there and bought up the land, and those farmers were forced off the land. A lot of them, you know, up here in upstate New York, they milk the cows, they pick the crops, and their dream is to get a farm up here. They want to be farmers, and they should be, because a lot of the young white folks who's, you know, the kids, they don't want to go into farming. They want to go into something else, and they need to pass them on to new people. There are a lot of Mexicans and Guatemalans and other people in Central America that should be the next generation of farmers in states like New York and other states. So I don't know if I got to the international question, but making foreign agriculture in other countries, like in our country, where a lot of our farmers are basically tenant farmers to Monsanto and corporate agribusiness, doing that in the other parts of the world is no good either. So if we set an example so farmers farm the land, and we also treat the farm laborers, you know, living wages, all labor protections, covering them, then we can talk to other countries about they don't need to be dependent on Bill Gates or Monsanto or whatever corporate trap they're in.
Great. So next we'll go to Rebecca. Let me get you unmuted.
Thank you. I just had two quick questions. One is, you mentioned that you were in communication with local chapters of the DSA. What is your general, or the Green Party's general communication with DSA like on a statewide and local level in terms of, like, is there any like electoral strategy, like who's running candidates in which district? And then two, sort of building on what Monty was saying, you know, Biden's climate plan is obviously not very strong, to say the least. And if Trump does win again through no fault of the Greens, because obviously the Democratic Party is not really, it's not a very active presence at the moment, where do you see the Green Party going? Because we do have this very small window, and it sort of shifts based on what happens in like the next year. So what do you see the Green Party turning into if it's like a point where our best option is just damage control and like mitigation?
Well, okay, DSA Green relations vary from community to community, state to state. So there's overlap in a lot of places. Greens are members of DSA. DSA used to be, you know, very focused on the Democratic Party. Now there's a debate going on in there. So those who have come from other socialist groups, like the International Socialist Organization, dissolved, and a lot of them committed to independent politics, went into DSA, as have a lot of other people, just because they were attracted to DSA after the Sanders campaign. So that debate goes on there, and it just varies from place to place. And as far as climate action, if Trump's elected, you know, we're in the streets, we do resistance, but we also go to the states. I mean, I ran on a Green New Deal for New York State 3 times for governor, and I always said, as New York goes, so goes the nation and the world. In New York would be the world's 10th largest economy by GDP, maybe 11th. It can have a big impact. And we think the economic benefits are so attractive in terms of jobs and economic expansion that it'll be attractive to other governments to take that role. So, you know, I think those would be the options. But frankly, I think Trump is toast. I mean, even his supporters, is the emperor with no clothes, and now they look and they say, yeah, actually he is naked. They're beginning to see it.
Okay, then that brings us to David. Let me go ahead, David.
Hello again. David Rockello, killradio.org. Starting with Angela, will you, both of you, be pursuing the Jesse Ventura endorsement? And what can you say about mending fences and bridge building with the folks, the delegates that didn't vote for you today?
But as far as attracting people who supported Mr. Ventura, just sticking with issues. You know, some people can't be appeased, and that's fine. We did not get into this expecting that there would be some universal hand-holding, kumbaya, you know, rainbows and sprinkles type of support. So as far as mending fences, we will continue to run the same positive campaign that we have, making sure that we are getting issues into people's hands, that the content that we are putting out is policy related and empowering to the communities that are receiving it. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
Yeah, I'll just add, you know, we ran a positive campaign, the whole campaign. Everybody run against us, been negative. A lot of it was just full out BS. The rigging we know about was against us. And we're not going to say who or what. We're going to take that up internally in the party. We're not going to put our business out on the street. And, you know, there are people who have shown, have broken trust and have attacked the Green Party. And while their supporters, you know, maybe some people were bamboozled by some of these candidates, sure, they're welcome. But some of the ringleaders in this thing, I mean, they've shown their hand. And, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You know, we ain't gonna be suckers for people that have no, don't have the Green Party's best interests at heart.
Great, so I think that's all the questions that we have for today. We wanna thank everybody for participating in this. And as you heard, if you need to get the video, you can write to media@gp.org to get a copy of the recording, and go to the howiehawkins.us website so that you can get updates on upcoming press conferences or reach out if you are interested in interviews. Any final words, Angela or Howie?